I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire.
Well, so that's Johnny Cash singing Ring of Fire, and written for his wife, June Carter Cash, who died on this day in 2003. So we remember her and her musicianship with a song dedicated to her by her husband, the late, great Johnny Cash. And reminding you on the way to this conversation that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. And we are about to take a leap into this question, a very thorny and difficult question to talk about for many, of the notion and idea and reality of what it means, what white privilege means. This started out, this recent discussion, because of a piece written in the conservative Princeton University newspaper, journal, called The Princeton Tory. It was written by a guy named Tal Fortang, for the class of 17 at Princeton, saying that he was tired of being told to watch his privilege and that it didn't fit him, that he came from a family of Holocaust victims, people who survived some of the toughest goings that as a people who were trying to be wiped out and came to America, and it didn't apply to him because of what his family had to do to struggle to get to where they are. So we read that, and then all of a sudden there was a stream of things being written. One of them that caught our attention immediately, we were going to do last week, but in our other studios, our machinery wasn't working, so we couldn't get him on the air, but we have him here with us today. Michael Denzel Smith, who writes for The Nation, wrote, "No one cares if you never apologize for your white male privilege," and he's one of our guests today, as well as Eli Plank, who wrote the piece "Dear Tal," an open letter about American Jewish privilege. So we're going to wrestle with this today with our guests. We have with us, as I said, Michael Denzel Smith, contributing writer for The Nation and blogger at TheNation.com. He's a Knobler Fellow at The Nation Institute, and as I said, wrote a response that we just mentioned. Eli Plank is a New York-based writer, organizer, and teacher who spent a decade working at the intersection of racial justice and education, and wrote the piece we mentioned in Zeke magazine, Z-E-E-K. And grew up in the world of the Workman Circle, which is something he and I have in common. And Hasdai Westbrook's in the studio, who's joined us before here to talk about neighborhoods in our communities in Baltimore. He's a partner at Changing Media, a digital agency devoted to social change. Good to see you again, Hasdai. And Michelle Antoinette, also known as Love the Poet, is with us in studio, indie spoken word artist, musician on a national performance and literary arts series, and author of Black Marks on White Paper and Love the Poet. Welcome. Good to have you here, Michelle.
Always good to be here.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can also tweet me, at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We really want to hear your thoughts on this. And, Michael, let me start with you.
So, all right.
And good to have you with us, man.
Thanks for having me.
So one of the interesting plays you approach this in response to the article by Tal Fortang. All these things are on our website. You can look at them as we're speaking. Is that we don't care if you apologize. The issue is not an apology. So I'm curious. Tell us your immediate response to what he wrote and why you wrote what you wrote.
I think where Tal Fortang was placing it was in a very personal realm, right? Like, he was tired of people telling him to check his privilege as if it was a personal attack on him. And I think that's part of what gets so difficult about the conversation around privilege, is that people see it as an indictment on their own personal life and successes. But what he's failing to see, and, you know, he's only 20, but I think that his thinking is reflective of a lot of particularly white men's thinking, in that he's failing to recognize the structures that have afforded him certain privileges in his life. Like I say in the piece, there is no American institution of power that is founded on the wholesale discrimination of white men. Like, that's just true. But it's also true that there are institutions that are founded on discrimination on the rest of us. And so as you practice a form of oppression on large swaths of people, that then gives the group of white men unearned privileges and benefits and power that they can't see because of or refuse to see because they themselves will go out and do work and get, you know, get jobs and get paid and all of these other things and get educational opportunities and so forth, but then see that as a result of their own hard work, as opposed to looking at how policy has shaped their destiny, essentially.
So has I. I'm glad you joined us today because you have differing opinions on this. I'm curious. You read both pieces.
I'm afraid I didn't get a chance to read Michael's piece, but I did read Tal's piece a few times. I don't know if I have a differing opinion. First of all, I think it's kind of absurd for anyone who's a student at Princeton, which is a bastion of privilege, to claim that they're not privileged in any way. I think that's crazy. But, I mean, I read his piece, I think, five times now, and I still am not sure what he was trying to say. And as a white Jewish male, you think I might have some insight, but I don't think I can claim that. But maybe that was part of his point, that we all have our different stories and viewpoints. But what he seems to be saying is that he doesn't say he's not privileged. He actually exalts in his privilege to a certain extent. He just thinks that it was honestly earned by the people before him, and strangely, I think, given America's history, had nothing to do with his being white, which I think is so. He believes that unearned advantage and privilege exists. It just has, in his case at least, has nothing to do with his ancestors being white or him being white. But to me, it's a sort of a strange position to take, because even if that's true, and I find that difficult to believe, I don't see how it's a virtuous thing to be the recipient of unearned inherited privilege. Mm-hmm. It still means that you're acknowledging that there is an unearned inequality. I mean, do the people who didn't have the avowedly hardworking, and I'm sure they were parents and grandparents who had it, you know, an awful history. Do the people who is the son of, low income person or a person who is in jail, think, do this person not deserve to go to Princeton? Does he deserve it more than they do? That's what I find bizarre about this piece.
I'm listening to what you're saying, and it's almost like me tracing my lineage and saying, you know, my ancestors were free. They weren't slaves. I'm not a black person who comes from that type of past. Why am I discriminated against when I go into the grocery store?
Right.
You know what I mean? I think that there's this blatant thing here in America that if you walk like a duck and talk like a duck, you're a duck.
Right.
So, you know, it's like I had a coworker say to me when President Obama was first elected, you know, after he was elected, it was a white male coworker, and he said, well, you know, he is one of us. His mother is white. And I said, and you say that now, but let me tell you something. When Barack Obama, before he was the president, Barack Obama would walk down the street, he was treated like an N-word. Whenever somebody felt like he was an N-word, it doesn't matter what his mother looks like. What matters is what he looks like.
Right.
So it is an unfortunate thing that we can't say, well, I'm actually from yada, 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 yada. But it's you are what you are when people see you as such.
Right.
And that's the idea of privilege. And when you are a walking, talking white man in America, you don't have many social controls, and you get that privilege.
So we have to take a short break here. When we come back, I'm going to go right to Eli Plank, and I'm going to raise the issue here about why it's so difficult for us. Now, I was sensing this from Michael's piece. I'm going to go right to Eli, though, for the first commentary about why it's so difficult to using the word privilege and what that does when you hear the word privilege and why there's so much pushback on the word privilege. So I'm going to come back and talk about that and rest with that. We are hearing Arrested Development, one of my favorite groups from a long while back, and we're doing that today because this is Baba O.J.'s birthday. He was born on this day in 1932. Arrested Development. Not in our conversation, though. 410-319-8888. Join us for your thoughts. We're here with Hasdai Westbrook, who is a partner in Changing Media, a digital agency devoted to social change, and Michelle Antoinette, spoken word artist, author of Black Marks and White Paper, Michael Denzel Smith, contributing writer for The Nation and a Nobler Fellow at The Nation Institute, and Eli Plank, who is a New York-based writer, organizer, and teacher, and spent a long time working in the intersection of racial justice and education. So, Eli, let me bring you in here.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So let me just throw this out. I want to see what our listeners think at 410-319-8888. I said this to Michael when he first was going to come be interviewed by me because of the piece he wrote, but then when we couldn't get our phones working that day. but one of the things I took from this, so I was really thinking about this, is when we started talking in our office about, was the idea of privilege. Sometimes words have deep meaning that we have difficult times wrestling with because of the word. And you know, because you hear, and I've heard this argument before in my years of organizing and working, working class white people, poor white people will say, privilege? You talk to me about privilege? My father's in jail. I'm working all my life. I've never been to college. I work in a factory. Got laid off. They closed the factory, and I have privilege? So start with that.
Well, I think it's important to understand privilege as something that can happen on many different planes. So there's people that are privileged because of their race, there's people that are privileged because of their gender, because of their sexual orientation, and because of their class. I mean, I think it's true that we rarely talk about class in this country, and as a result, we're sort of a race-obsessed country, I think.
What? Say that again? I didn't hear you.
I said we're sort of a race-obsessed country.
Race-obsessed. Gotcha.
See things almost exclusively in racial terms, which can be problematic because race is not the entire story. But I do think there's something to be said for those people who say, I'm working class, I don't have privilege. And in terms of class, that's true. You know, if you're working class or poor, you're really marginalized in this country. That being said, you can still be white and have some privilege as a result of being white. You know, maybe it means that you walk down the street in New York City and, like, you don't get stopped and frisked 10 times a day because people don't think that you're a drug dealer just because of the color of your skin. Like, maybe it means that you do have access to certain government benefits and that you've had access to those for hundreds of years. I think federal housing and all these different things around sort of redlining and the development of suburbs is a good example of, like, how even working-class white people have had access to certain opportunities that for a long time were denied to people of color and to a certain extent still are. So I think it's not productive to play this sort of, like, oppression Olympics, like, who's more oppressed. I think it's important to understand that our identities and the ways in which we engage with privilege is shaped by sort of intersectionality, and and almost all of us are probably marginalized in some ways and privileged in others. But if we're having a conversation about race, I think all white people in this country are privileged to a certain extent.
So let me do this. I'm going to go around the room here and to respond to that. And before we go to the phones, Antonio, you're our first caller up. We're going to get to your call. But Michael, let me let you weigh in, then we'll go around the room here in the studio.
Yeah, I mean, I hear the thing about, like, white working class and poor people, like, feeling like they're being set out of the same system. Absolutely, like, capitalism eats us all alive, right? But yeah. When JFK visited Appalachia, he went back to the White House and instituted the modern food stamp program. 20-some years later, we're trying to cut the food stamp program on the backs of so-called welfare queens. Like, that's what white privilege looks like. Mm.
That's a powerful thing to say.
That's a very powerful thing to say.
Hasdai.
So this may be where I differ somewhat in outlook. I think that in some ways the privilege analysis and debate is somewhat counterproductive. And the fact is that what bothered me, I mean, both about the original op-ed and then the kind of flame war that came up on the internet that we are now sort of talking about, is that it's essentially a discussion among privileged people, among people who have the time on their hands, the education, the access to spend their time discussing the finer points of privilege with each other. And I think that a more useful, at least to me, conversation And let me make the caveat, I guess it's almost obligatory, that I, as I said before, I fully acknowledge much of this analysis. I think that as a white male, myself and the author of this original piece have been the beneficiaries of historical and contemporary racism, past and present. There's no question. I think it's just kind of crazy to deny that. But that aside, one of the reasons I think you get this pushback is because it's felt as a personal attack, and it does lead to this oppression Olympics and suffer Olympics and who had it harder and whose parents had it harder. I think a more useful discourse is not about privilege but about inequality, because as I said, I think there are we have huge, huge inequalities in this country and this society to do with socioeconomics, to do with class, as Eli was saying. And obviously race is a huge factor in many of those things, but we have these huge inequalities in education, in criminal justice, and those are the things I think we should try and get people to coalesce around and really respond to our common humanity and to the suffering of our fellow citizens, not to try and make everyone take a constant kind of moral inventory of their portion of sin in that process. I ultimately don't think that's a particularly helpful discourse.
I think that this is a topic because the people who instituted these social controls and society in America as it is are now having an issue because people are not shy about saying that you have a privilege because you have instituted your privilege and it exists. And so now that people are going, wait a minute, whoa. I mean, that doesn't really have much to do with me. That was my ancestry or whatever. But the fact is that you are a descendant and thus reap the benefits of this said privilege. For example, I'm a black lesbian woman in America. Wow, that's a lot. So when I look at something like the gay rights movement, I realize that it's only a movement because in some place somewhere a gay white man said, I need to not feel like I can't do what I do on a regular basis. But that gay white man can put on a suit and walk into a building and not be treated any kind of way unless he says, I'm gay. So he can put that on, he can take that off, he can do what he wants with it when he wants to do it with it. I cannot take off brown. I cannot put that away. When black women were slaves or in the homes being maids or whatever and treated, however, that wasn't necessarily an issue until white women decided that they were tired of being treated a certain way, thus the feminist movement. So my point here is that this is only a conversation because the word privilege stings.
And I think that's why it's important to me to sort of have it, I guess. I think that there's something to be said for having an awareness of your own privilege. And I think privilege and power are really connected. And so if you have this level of societal power, there's some responsibility to do something positive or at least do something that doesn't actively oppress people. And I think given the sort of socialization of white people and also the socialization of ruling class people, I think if you're not actively dealing with your privilege and sort of actively doing something that makes the world a better place, you're continuing a status quo that is making the world a worse place, that is continuing to marginalize people. So I think this term, check your privilege, I've often seen it emerge, especially in academic spaces, from women and people of color and other, other people from marginalized communities as a way to be like, you know, you really need to interrogate sort of how much space you take up here and how you take up the space and who you might be silencing as a result of that. And to me, that feels like a worthwhile road to go down, at least on an interpersonal level. I mean, I agree on a systemic level. There are these huge economic problems that are very connected to race that need to be dealt with. But they, too, in some ways relate to privilege.
Let me open the phones here. And a lot of interesting points were raised here, and I kind of want to come back to this nature of privilege in America and what that means when it comes to race and if there's and how we address it, given what Michael was saying earlier, that we have a world, a capitalist world, where everyone in the society is oppressed because of that, and all the whole nature of capitalism wouldn't have existed in the West without slavery. Mm-hmm. And how that plays into the mindsets. Mm-hmm. And I think about the own struggles of my own family growing up, where people had difficulties dealing with this because our family did come from the Holocaust, because there were people with numbers in their arms in my living room that I grew up with. So you grew up with that sense of oppression, but that was different when you walked somewhere else and they didn't realize that you were, but you were just another white person walking around the street. So that's let's come back to 410-319-8888. Antonio, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hello, Mark.
Hi.
First, I'd like to thank you for having the conversation.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank you for having the conversation. I'd just like to say that my sense is the reason for the anomaly is that the languaging that's been created is what gave the notion of privilege in the first place, and that really all that's required is to be able to relanguage it such that privilege is not the word that's used, because I think given the way that it has evolved in this society, it actually smacks to people who are marginalized and affected by it. I think you could relanguage it as, instead of white privilege, you could say that what it is actually is it's inherited white supremacist conditioning, so that what happens is that people who use it are not rewarded by saying that it's some kind of privilege. Actually, in fact, when it's misused, it's not given in that way at all, when in terms of the effect that it has on people of color who are marginalized. The other thing is, I'd like to say really briefly that the notion of race in this country is a notion that a lot of us who are people of color need to come to accept that it is indelibly etched in the fabric of this culture in the United States. And while it's useful to confront it, and it's useful to be engaged in the struggle to try to shift it, the reality is that in the coming generations and probably in the coming centuries, it's not likely that this is going to change very much, because what you have is 400 years of embedded, repeated conditioning of people to have white supremacist ideas. And so I remember when I was going to City College in the old days, the Glee Club, we used to have a song that we sang in the Glee Club that came from a movie, a musical, a Rodgers and Hammerstein's movie called South Pacific. And one of the key songs in the musical was, "You have to be carefully taught." And it goes, "Before you are 6 or 7 or 8, you have to be taught to hate all the people your relatives hate. Before you are 6 or 7 or 8, you have to be carefully taught." So what I'm saying is that 400 years of that is deeply embedded in the South and Midwest, such that while it's useful to fight about this, the notion that this is somehow going to change anytime in the near future is folly. And so it's best to adjust to the fact that it's going to be the way that it is, and then to join with folks like you who are one of our heroes, because you traditionally provide a forum for us to be able to at least explore and talk about these things and improve it to the extent that we can. So thanks very much for taking my call.
Antonio, thanks so much. Michael, let me ask you to wrestle with this first before we go back to the phones. I mean, this, as both as a wordsmith, many people on this panel, they are wordsmiths, I just realized. But the idea of how we use the language, but also I'd like to wrestle a minute about the idea of, can this change, and is it changing? First, the words question. Michael?
Yeah, I absolutely agree that the more relevant discussion is one around white supremacy as the governing philosophy of the United States since its inception. Like, that's what we're ultimately wrestling with. I think the language of privilege is sort of personalized in a way that you're trying to get people that don't understand the effects of oppression to see themselves and their position in it, right? Mm-hmm. So you're trying to get people to see that the result of oppression is not just that people that they may see as just complaining about their station in life are not just complaining because their reality is one that they don't want. It's because you like the person that benefits from privilege are getting these things without ever having to think about them. Like, these are just things that happen in your life that you never have to think about, and it's a result of white supremacy, white supremacy, patriarchy, heterosexism, whatever a form of oppression we're talking about in relation to privilege. But there's limitations to that conversation about privilege that I agree with, in that it does leave it in the realm of the personal. And so if we're not marrying that conversation with one institutional analysis, then we're definitely going to stagnate. And I think to the question of does this change, it doesn't change if the people who are benefiting from the white supremacist, patriarchal, heterosexist, like, capitalist system are not willing to address that, right? Like, so if we're not engaged in conversation with people around these issues, then no, it doesn't change. If we're not making the moral case, if we're not making a push towards equality and justice, then it does not change. And it changes very slowly, as we see. I hear the question all the time, like, because I write about and speak on these issues, is that aren't things better now? And I just want to keep saying to them, it doesn't really matter if it's better now, right? Like, yes, we're better than chattel slavery. We're better than legal segregation, sure. But that doesn't then take away from the fact that, you know, we're still dealing with mass incarceration. We're dealing with the erosion of the social safety net. We're dealing with the closing of schools and education gap. Like, all of these different, like, we're dealing with food insecurity. All of these issues that are residuals from that oppression and the continued oppression of people of color. So ultimately, to say that, yes, like, it becomes a daunting thing to think that this will not change. Like, there's just going to be a new form of oppression practice and to replace the one that we address, so long as we adhere to the philosophy of the ideology of white supremacy. So that's why the conversation about white supremacy is so important.
So to push a little bit on that, I mean, I think that and before we go back to the phones here, that unless you are deeply engaged and involved in the world of white supremacy, which there are a huge body of people who are involved in that in America, white people don't think about being white because they don't have to think about being white.
They don't have to.
Right. They don't have to. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So at the same time, I think that there are struggles for the generation coming up that you all are part of, from one end of the spectrum to the other, that's going to be different in this 21st century in addressing this than what, and I'll say we, because of the generation who went to Mississippi and ended segregation and all the other things that ended terror in the South, which is what King really did, was to end racial terror in the South,
right,
more than anything. That the struggles here are going to be different. The struggles still exist, but they're different because things on some levels have progressed, but the nature of capitalism where it's put ourselves now, that the oppression that Michael just outlined is very deep.
If I may talk about the word, to go back to your first question.
Word privilege?
The word privilege.
Yes, go ahead.
Being a wordsmith, I looked it up just so we can define terms. Privilege, a special right, advantage, or immunity granted or available only to a particular person or group of people. Privilege. We are not calling a spade a club. We are calling a spade a spade when we use the term white privilege. There is no need to argue semantics. There is no need to change the term. It means what it means. And in America, or in any situation, when you build a construct, it is yours to either abide by and fall in line and lead by example, or it is yours to thwart the rules and do what you will with it. Now, we can say that white people don't think about being white. You can also say most, you know, there's a stereotype that most black people have rhythm. You can also say when you go, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So when I go into a party, you could say, oh, she's not thinking about the fact that she has rhythm. She just dances because that's just what she does. But I will beg to differ. Sometimes I go into a party and I am excited about the fact that I have rhythm, that I was gifted with my rhythm. So what I'm saying is when a white man or a white woman walks into a place, it doesn't matter. They might not ever tell you, but there's a voice inside their head that might say, you know what? I'm real glad I'm white in here. Because there may be this one brown person or two or three brown people that they're watching being chased around a store because of the way that they look. So that's what I'm saying. Like, the word privilege is not necessarily a misnomer here. It absolutely fits. So I don't think we need to do that. Good or bad, the word means what it means. So we just need to address it in the reality that it is. And it's only a problem because the people are finally being forced to see that other people see it and they will call you out on it. I think that's the only problem we're having here.
I agree.
And I don't even think that is a problem. I think that's actually kind of great that that's finally happening.
Right. But some people don't.
Yeah, right. I mean, sure. I mean, I think there's this way in which it's important to make the invisible visible, that there are these sort of invisible hands that give people things or allow people to do things, and that part of the work, I agree with Michael wholeheartedly that the sort of big picture work is dealing with white supremacy and capitalism. Those are definitely like the twin evils of our world as far as I'm concerned. But I think part of doing that work is understanding the ways in which these large scale systems of power are visible and operate in our everyday lives. And that will allow us to sort of have a systemic analysis.
How's that?
Well, the one thing I'd take objection to is I don't claim to know what's in another person's mind, and I don't think anyone can. That said, I think it's interesting the example Michelle brought up because it makes me think of this bit by Chris Rock that he said, you know, he's in a stand-up show, he said, there isn't a white guy in here that would trade places with me, and I'm rich.
And that's real.
Right.
And
right.
That is real.
That is real.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what I would say just very briefly is, you know, it's difficult for me in some ways because I think America affords people the opportunity, unlike some other places, to avoid the other. And for me, I come from a slightly different background. It's no newsflash to me that being white and not poor affords me great privilege, that my life is going to be better than other people's, at least materially. That's no newsflash to me. I think, unfortunately, in America, because you have a certain ethos, especially in conservative politics, it really comes down to a question of whether you care about that or not. I would question whether I need to continually recognize my benefit from those systems in portion to care. I care anyway. Mm-hmm. I always have. I've always had a social conscience. I can tell you some specific personal narrative examples of why that is. It has a lot to do with growing up in London and going on the London Underground and being around people who are different from me, mm-hmm. whether by, you know, racial or cultural or national background or socioeconomic status. But point being that I care, and I think that what we're fundamentally sort of running up against here is whether you care or not, and that usually divides down political lines, and no amount of wordsmithing, I don't think there's any point. I agree in changing the word. It's not going to change. No amount of diversity workshops is going to change the people who do not care about those things.
I agree, but
it's a little fatalistic, though, to say that you're just going to care or not. Like, I work a lot with young people and like doing sort of training young people to be organizers, and I think there's this consciousness raising that does take place, like in many people's minds, and not only young people. I mean, you know, older people as well, but especially young people, where they don't really understand the stuff. And then when they're able to see it and understand it, they do want to do something. And so in terms of training the next generation of change makers, I think this is an important term and an important sort of construct to move forward.
If I could just very briefly, I mean, I actually absolutely agree that I think we can instill in people a broad social conscience. I'm just not certain myself that it necessarily needs to play out in these specific terms.
And so we're going to take a brief break here in a moment, but I'm going to ask if you all can stay with us another 5 minutes to sort of bleed over. Tony, I want to get to your call here in Baltimore, and Alan, if we can get to your call as well, we'll try. And because we have another segment coming up that we have to deal with in terms of whether kids in Baltimore should have curfews, and we have to wrestle with that one. but I do want to come back to this, and really what I didn't say clearly before was that I think that part of the 21st century struggle in America will be directed at the issue of privilege and institutional racism, and because those were not really part of a struggle before, with a conscious struggle before,
right.
Because the conscious struggle then was the making people realize about the overt racism, classism that took place in our inner cities and ending segregation. The battle of the 21st century is going to be the battle we're talking about now, I think, and I want you to throw that out about where that is and why and how we do that. And we'll come right back and go to Tony and then wrestle that for a few minutes and go to our next group of guests who are waiting to come in. We are going out to break here with Peru singing You Return to the Evening, a song that commemorates the Nakba, which is what Palestinians honor on this day when they were forced out of their homes during the Battle of 1948. Stay with us. Mr. Wendell, Arrested Development, playing it because this is Baba O.J.'s birthday. Of course, remember Arrested Development, born on this day in 1932, one of the elders of Arrested Development. We are here with Michael Denzel Smith. Denzel Smith, who is a contributing writer to The Nation, a Knobler Fellow at The Nation Institute. Eli Plank, a New York-based writer, organizer, and teacher who spent a decade working at the intersection of racial justice and education. Hasdai Westbrook, in Baltimore here, partner of Changing Media, a digital agency devoted to social change. And Michelle Antoinette, a.k.a. Love the Poet, the indie spoken word artist, musician, nationally renowned, who wrote the book, who wrote Black Marks on White Paper. 410-319-8888. I'm going to go right to the phones to get this call, do a round of comment, and then move on to our next segment. Tony, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, sir, for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
Whenever I'm involved or hear a conversation about racism or white supremacy or white privilege, I always speak from the context or the perspective of the Rodney King video. And what I mean by that, anyone that looks at that would clearly say that the four police officers that beat him down were racist. But if you really look at the video closely, there are 21 police officers on the scene. My contention, my point is that all of them are guilty, even though there are four that actively beat the man down. The other 17 that stood there and watched that behavior and didn't step into his defense or anything are just as guilty. And I might add that some of those are African-American police officers as well.
Tony, I appreciate that call and your commentary, and I think that you have this a very strong piece of commentary, and we can comment on that as we close out our session, and let's just go around the room here, and Michael, let me let you begin as we round this up, this notion of as looking at the notion of white privilege is, do you agree or disagree that that and the struggle around racial institutionalized racism are the 21st century struggles?
I mean, obviously, we're going to still battle with racism. The question is the framing of white privilege going to help us better understand and then undo white supremacy and racism? And I can see ways that it is helpful, and I can see ways that it's limiting. But I think that ultimately, yeah, we have to use all the tools in our toolbox. And so if the language of privilege helps you explain a concept to someone that would not be receptive to that message otherwise, then I say use it. If privilege is something that, is too difficult for someone to wrap their mind around, like the Tal Fort gang, for example, then you're just beating your head against the wall, and, that's not productive, and that's not getting us anywhere in the conversation, then you know, we have to come up with other tools. We have to come up with other ideas. I think that, you know, I'm just all hands on deck. Everything that will work, use it and let it work.
All right. Michelle.
I believe that, you know, in a situation like this, power is typically not given up. It's taken, you know, and I think that the privileged don't easily give up their privilege. They don't easily step down from their privilege. And I think that in our country right now, we are at a point where there was a very large Band-Aid placed on very deep-rooted issues. And at this point, with President Barack Obama being in office and the, like you said, Mark, the mass support he got being elected, but also the massive pushback he received for what he looked like, for the way he was, the preconceived notions about how he was going to operate because of what he looked like, shows us that we now have to dig deeper. And if the beginning of chiseling away at this starts with us saying, hey, I'm going to say it out loud, there is a such thing as white privilege, just to bring it to the forefront, if that's what we need to do, then we need to do it. I don't know, just like I started off, I don't know if the privileged who have the privilege, who have instituted this whole situation, will ever say, hey, you know what? You're right. Let me fall in line and get with the people on that very basic level. We don't know if that's ever going to happen. But if we can call it out and not be afraid to call it out, therein lies the beginnings of getting to a very deep-rooted issue and killing it at its root, because this Band-Aid has been ripped off.
Hasdai, closing thought, and then we go to Eli. And
Well, I think that the struggle with diversity is going to be a defining trend of the 21st century for America, and I worry about some of the things that Michelle referred to in a kind of increasingly desperate, reactionary kind of largely white, increasingly minority point of view that's going to struggle perhaps violently against the tide of history.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think, is going to be a dominant trend. I think interwoven with that, and perhaps even more important, is going to be this struggle with what America is and what equality means in America, and whether we can have a society that is so far out of whack where our economic system is not only perpetuating inequality in our society, it might even be damaging the economy for us all. And so in that struggle, I personally think that ultimately trying to find common universal values that go beyond individual concerns is going to be the only way forward.
And Eli?
I think in my work, as a sort of someone who does education around race and racial justice, privilege is a helpful sort of piece of language, especially in white communities. And I sort of have some hope that there's a lot of white people who, under the right, sort of in the right context, will really sort of wake up and see what's going on. Maybe that's a little too hopeful. I'm not totally sure. I think in terms of the 21st century being the century where we deal with race, in some ways, I think the 20th century was defined by race, and I sort of hope the 21st century will be defined by class struggles that understand the role that race and gender and sexuality and all these other things play. And I think that's where it's helpful to understand privilege, is to understand it as part of this sort of intersectional analysis of identity that I'm hoping will allow us to have a more holistic view of how to begin making the world a better place.
We'll see how this all tumbles out. We'll do more of these conversations, and sorry we can't get more callers here, but we need to go on to our next conversation. And I'll just say that I think that probably the majority, that there will be a strong minority of white Americans who will wrestle and deal with this and address a new society. And there's going to be a large body of the majority who will resist, because it's a very tough whole thing to accept that this is who we are. But I think it's changing, because I think the conversation is finally happening in ways that it hasn't happened before, on people who really do want to see a new way, a new place, a new society for us to build. I do believe that. So I think it's a struggle. La luta continua.
Yeah, absolutely.
Michael Denzel Smith, thank you so much for what you're writing for The Nation. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Always. And Eli Plank, great to meet you for the first time. Glad that you're out there doing what you do as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Hasdai Westbrook, it's great, the second time on the air with us, and I appreciate your coming in and being willing to get into this.
Thank you.
To have you back with us. The work you're doing, Michelle Antoinette, a.k.a. Love Deport. What else can I say?
Love you too, Mark.
All right, baby. We have to take a brief break, and we will come right back as we wrestle with what the city council just passed, and is it good or bad for our children and communities to install a curfew and have the police involved? Maybe it is, maybe it's not. We have both sides here with us. Stay with us. Don't go away. We're going back out again. More Arrested Development? Yes, it is more Arrested Development. All right. Let's just play that. No, I'm just kidding. We're right back. Twice about spending on an old bum until I had the chance to really get to know one. Now that I know him, to give him money isn't charity. He gives me some knowledge, I buy him some shoes. And to think blacks spend all their money on big colleges, still most of y'all come out confused. Go ahead, Mr. Wendell.